It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. I'm live on Sundays here on News Talk WSB. So glad you could join us for a special show today. I have invited four of the smartest people I know to come in and talk about your money and the economy and how it's all going to tie together. I was thinking about this. I was watching CNBC last week, and I thought, you know, we really need a little bit of perspective here. It's not just enough to kind of look around at our own backyards every time. I mean, really, real estate is so local. It is about what's going on in your backyard. But sometimes we need to bring in a little bit of other perspective to give you a little more insight into what could happen over the second half of the year. If you want to join me online, you can. My website, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Don't forget to join me on Twitter. I am at Glink, at Glink. If you want details and contact information for our guests today, you're going to want to go to the thinkglink.com blog, where we will post all kinds of information about this as well. My first guest is Greg McBride, a longtime contact and friend of mine. He's a senior financial analyst and vice president for Bankrate.com. And Bankrate, as you know, is one of my favorite websites to go to for mortgage information, home equity information. In fact, any kind of loan that you could get, CDs, all the rest, all of it is there at Bankrate.com, which is great. But in addition, there's other kinds of information there as well. And Greg provides in-depth commentary and analysis and all kinds of practical advice for consumers. And I thought he'd be a perfect way to start off the show. So, Greg, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Thank you very much, Elise. It's great to be with you.
Perfect. So, as we reach the midterm of our summer of Greek discontent, I just love that. It all sounds so Shakespearean. But seriously, you know, things are really heating up in Europe. I keep hearing all the time about how this is going to affect the U.S. I have some pretty strong feelings about how we're heading back into recession. I hope I'm wrong, but I'm feeling like there's just a lot of missing pieces here. You know, when you start hearing the Fed talk about a QE3 and they're going to pump hundreds of millions of dollars back into the economy, you look at Europe, they're in recession, serious unemployment issues there, China's slowing down. It seems like the world is, you know, coming apart at the seams this summer. From where you sit, is that what you're seeing?
Well, here's the pattern that, you know, we're seeing, and it sounds very familiar, looks very familiar, because it's very familiar to what we've done each of the last 2 years. If you divide the calendar year into thirds, the pattern of 2010, 2011, and, you know, so far 2012, is that the first third of the year, everything looks hunky-dory, economy's doing better, stock market does well, people start to feel better confidence-wise, and then we hit a soft patch in the middle third of the year where economic data is softer. There's usually some sort of financial crisis in Europe, and then all of a sudden people start to worry about recession. They clutch the pocketbooks a little bit tighter, and, you know, I think we're going down a similar path this year to what we've done each of the last 2 years.
Except
the difference, Elise, is this. Each successive year, the economy is producing at a higher level than it was the year prior. So the highs are higher, but the lows are higher, too. We're on stronger footing now than we were 12 months ago. We were on stronger footing then than we were the year before. And I expect that a year from now, we'll be on stronger footing than we are today.
All right,
but we're
going
to have to dance around some issues first.
You're like every realtor on the block, right? You're optimistic more about the economy. The problem I'm having is that we're in an election year. So historically, and you've been in this business long enough to know, that every presidential election year, you see a dramatic slowdown in real estate in the 6 to 9 months leading up to the election as people are really unsure about what's going to happen. They get more and more unsure as you get closer and closer to that actual election day. Then you have the added craziness at the end of this year with the Bush tax cuts expiring. You have the mandatory cuts if the political system can't come to grips with what has to be done. So you've got these draconian cuts that are going to go into effect. So you have, I think, an unusual amount of insecurity about these kinds of major things and what's going to happen to the economy. And I don't think this is going to be anything but a deeply divisive and crazy kind of an election year. So don't you think it's a little different than the last couple of years?
Well, look at last year. We had the debt ceiling debacle, a debt rating downgrade, a barrage of poor economic data, and a stock market correction all within 6 months. Or 6 weeks, rather. All within 6 weeks. And so, and you know, which was a scary time. A lot of people thought we were going into a recession then. Didn't turn out to be the case. So, no, I there's no denying there's a ton of uncertainty with regard to this time around. And you've hit on all of them. The fiscal cliff, Europe's debt issues, the slowing growth in emerging economies, not to mention just the uncertainty about the election. We have had a stock market correction already. Gas prices are still a threat, even though they pulled back nicely over the last month. Household incomes are stagnant. People just, they don't have the confidence or the spending power. So, yeah, those are the issues I was talking about that we're going to have to navigate our way around in the second half of this year. But you know, I think the precedent is there that, you know, much like last year, even when things look pretty dire, you know, we still managed to evade that worst-case scenario.
Which is all good. I don't really want there to be a recession. I just feel like, it's not that even that I feel like it's 1937 all over again, although I guess it could be if the cuts go into effect. And 2013 could just be a nightmare. But we'll see how that goes. Another issue of concern that I'm seeing and hearing from every single week from my listeners is the HARP plan. So people are still getting offers of loan modifications, requiring them to kill their credit before, you know, with the three payments, which is just silly. We had a woman call the show last week, and she said, yeah, I've been offered a loan modification. It's so good, I can hardly believe I'm getting it offered. But they said it's a temporary, and I have to make three on-time payments. But I've been on time all the way. They're going to report me as negative, and the payment required is half of what I've been doing. So if I've been managing $450 a month, and now I'm going to pay $225, what's there to guess at? Why do they have to destroy my credit to actually have this go through? And it's kind of interesting because you feel like HARP should be all on the right path by now. We had heard how HARP was going to start the end of last year, November 1st, December 1st, and that for people way underwater, that was going to happen first third of the year. Here we are, middle of the year, and I don't know, is HARP really rolling along?
Well, HARP and modifications are two different programs.
True.
HARP and HAMP. HAMP, you know, the modification program, don't get me started. It's been a huge waste of time. It does nothing but kick the can down the road. HARP, on the other hand, although the much-needed enhancements came, in my opinion, 3 years too late, better late than never. And so the ability for people to refinance that are deeply upside down, that has just really started to take effect and gather some momentum here since March, is really starting to pay dividends because I mentioned earlier, household incomes have been stagnant. People's spending power is really crimped. And so refinancing that mortgage at today's ultra-low mortgage rates, and they've never been lower, is going to put some extra money in people's pocketbooks that they're not getting from their paychecks. So it's a very significant, not only in terms of creating a little bit of breathing room in household budgets, but getting people out of loans to which they're ill-suited, getting people out of an adjustable rate mortgage into a fixed rate loan, putting people in a situation where they have the permanent payment affordability of a fixed rate mortgage, and it's going to avoid a preventable foreclosure down the road. I mean, you talk about keeping people in their houses. HARP, the refinancing program, rewards the right people. It rewards the people that have been making their payments on time all along, and just gives them the benefit of being able to refinance at today's low rates, even though they're upside down.
But not everybody can do it, and not every lender is doing it. Is that what you're finding? Because we're hearing from people who are trying to go through the HARP program, and they're being told, well, you don't qualify, or this, or, you know, there are. It's not as easy as you kind of make it seem.
Well, anything the government's involved in is never easy.
So true.
That's not to say there, you know, there isn't plenty of red tape involved. But look, if you know, if you're willing to put in a little bit of effort and persistence, and you can shave several hundred dollars off your monthly payments, you know, I would say it's worth it. And the numbers have gone up dramatically. You know, there are more of these loans, a lot more of these loans being done now. You know, as many as a third of refinancing applications are for the HARP program. So it's starting to gather some momentum. And, you know, my advice to people is, look, if you're getting a song and dance from one lender, there's plenty of fish in the sea. try another one. That's, you know, really the whole essence of shopping around is, you know, trying to get the best deal that you can. And, you know, sometimes that shopping around is also important in terms of getting the consistency of the message.
The
first person who tells you you're not eligible doesn't necessarily mean you're not eligible. They may be reading from the wrong script. You call somebody else, you might get a different answer.
I've said that so many times during this whole thing where it's like, okay, you don't like the answers you're getting, just hang up and try again, because the next person might be smarter, better able to suit you, you know, have a better attitude, woke up on the right side of the bed, who knows?
Yeah, we've all had that experience in one customer service contact or another.
Right. So with HARP, I think one of the misconceptions, and you just touched on it, is this idea that you can only go to your own lender. But instead, this program is designed to shop around to how many lenders? Can you shop around to anybody? Or is it just the 40 lenders who are kind of involved with the government programs, making home affordable? There's about, I think, 40 or 42 lenders there. What are you hearing?
Well, the bulk of these are being done through the largest lenders. I mean, that's where most people are currently have their loans being serviced. In other words, who they're making their payments to every month. But that's not to be a barrier for you shopping around and trying to secure a better deal. So, you know, although there tends to be a log jam at the top in terms of the most the largest lenders, they're doing the most loans. That doesn't mean that your field is necessarily limited to 3, 4, or 5 names. There are a lot of smaller lenders that are very eager to do business in this area, and that's again why it really pays to shop around, and that's how you're going to uncover the best terms.
So let's talk a little bit about the shadow inventory. This is sort of the amorphous dark hole of people who are so far underwater they might just walk away, or people who haven't made a payment in 3 years, 2-3 years, they're just sort of waiting for their number to be called at the foreclosure auction. You know, where does that stand? Because I actually saw a number the other day that suggested that maybe the foreclosure inventory is far smaller than people were imagining. I've seen numbers as high as 4 million that are possible foreclosure inventory. The number I saw the other day was something under 400,000. What are you hearing?
Well, that shadow inventory is still still a serious concern, and that's really going to, I think, keep a lid on prices just because of that overhang of distressed properties that really have to work their way through the entire foreclosure pipeline before we can get those properties turned over, get people that aren't paying out, and get people that will pay in. You know, that's really the essence for recovery in the housing market. It's just going to take several years because, you know, despite record low mortgage rates, despite a sharp drop in home prices, and some of the best prices you've seen in a decade and best affordability you've seen in decades, people just aren't confident enough to buy houses because a lot of that economic uncertainty that we talked about earlier. So the inventory is still significant, and it's coming onto the market at a very slow pace. And you know, all the sales have picked up, they're still at a fairly slow pace. So that just suggests that it's going to take us longer in order to work through that backlog.
Oh, which is good. Greg McBride is a senior financial analyst and vice president for BankGreek.com. Greg, I'm going to have you back in about a month to talk and see if we've made any progress as we sort of move forward in this. So you'll have to watch the markets for us.
Let's hope.
All right. Greg McBride, you can find him at BankRate.com. They have a Bank Rate Money Makeover Series, and Greg helps consumers plan for retirement, managing debt, and developing appropriate investment allocations, asset allocations. It is so important. I'm Elyse Glink. This is the Elyse Glink Show. Stay tuned. We have Liz Weston coming up next. Liz Weston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of several books, and she has been a frequent guest on the program. She's going to talk about your money and how you need to think about it as you go through the year planning for what might be the financial cliff. We don't know, the fiscal cliff. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elyse Glink Show on News Talk WSB. Coming up next, we have my good friend Liz Weston, her book, The 10 Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy. I've asked her to come on and talk with us about what you can do to make sure the numbers tie out. It's such a tough year. Nobody's really getting raises. We still have a lot of people unemployed. And it just seems to me that if we're not careful with what we have, if we're not putting away 10 or 15% of our income, whether it's in a 401k or a Roth IRA or just in an old-fashioned savings account, if the worst happens, if we end up in recession, as I think we may, despite what Greg says, I still think we are heading that way. I hope we're not. Hope I'm wrong, but I think we are. And if you don't have cash in the bank, you are going to have a really tough time evaluating options. You know why? Because you're not going to have any. So Liz is going to come on. We're going to talk about where to put your money, how to think about saving, and survive and thrive in this new economy. I'm Elise Kling. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Here on Sunday mornings, 11 to 1 on News Talk WSB. So glad you could join me today. Don't forget to go to the website thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. And if you've missed a show, we podcast them all. No need to do without. Just go to the website. You can listen online, click on the podcast button, or you can actually go to iTunes, where we have all of the shows for years and years and years and years, however far back we started doing this. All of them are at iTunes as well. And then don't forget to go to Amazon.com. And if you are looking to invest in real estate, I have that series of ebooks that are online at Amazon. Just click on the ebooks tab. And there's also our best-selling ebook, The Clutter Collector, How to Organize Every Single Thing in Your House. You might find that helpful as well. And if you do, you can buy it right then and there. Always, always happy to have you shop at Amazon. All right, we have Liz Weston with us. She is the amazing Liz Weston. She's the author of the new 10 Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy, and several other books, including Your Credit Score. She's been a guest on the show more times than I can count, and she writes the best-read financial blog over at MSN Money. Liz, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Elise. It's always great to be here.
It is good to be here. So people are talking, and we had a bunch of questions last week about this, about inheritances and wills, people contesting wills and what they can do, people trying to figure out what they should do with inheritances they don't want. I know this is something you tackle in the book, The Ten Commandments of Money, but, you know, where are we? What are people thinking about today, especially baby boomers?
Well, the interesting thing is I think that there's a lot of talk about all the money that's going to be coming to the baby boomers and then to their kids. $27 trillion over 40 years was the last number I saw, which is pretty impressive. But what people don't realize is the vast majority of that money is going from very wealthy families to their already well-off kids. And what's happening with the great majority is that the older folks are living longer than expected. They are incurring much higher medical bills than expected. And then throw in what happened with the recession and the aftermath. The house isn't worth as much anymore. Their investments aren't worth as much anymore. So what I'm seeing is kind of a turn from, you know, what will mom and dad leave me to, am I going to have to pay for mom and dad? You know, are my parents going to be moving back in with me?
It's like the sandwich generation.
Things that people didn't really think about, I don't think, too much a couple of years ago.
No, it's that whole sandwich generation thing that we've been hearing about for years and years, but now it's suddenly on your doorstep.
Exactly, and you don't want your, you know, parents to suffer, obviously, and you want to take care of them, but you've also got kids to get through college, you've got your own retirement to think about, and it can be a real squeeze. And we may see a lot more multi-generational households going forward, because that used to be the norm. I mean, think about the Waltons with grandma and grandpa living upstairs or whatever.
Good night, John. John Boy.
Exactly. Right. So it's actually been a fairly short period of time where seniors had the wherewithal to live on their own. They have Social Security and they have Medicare, and those two things just revolutionized how seniors could live. But now we're seeing a lot of strains on the money that's there, so more people are going to have to think about, you know, not just the fact that they're not going to get anything from mom and dad or very little, but that they may have to support them. And then if there is anything there, your parents are living long enough that if one of them dies, the other one very well could remarry. And you could be looking at, you know, splitting an inheritance with somebody who's about your age. So there's a lot of complications going on here.
Yes, I'm definitely seeing more women marrying younger men. So that's what you meant, right, of course?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So it's interesting to think about in terms of housing because, you know, on the show we talk so much about real estate. But, I'm seeing people who are inheriting houses that they thought they were going to get free and clear. And not only is the house not free and clear, right, because the baby boomer went out and remortgaged it maybe 10 mm-hmm. years ago or 3 years ago or last year right before they died, but the house has dropped in value dramatically. And so many of these houses are either sort of at par where they're worth about what the mortgage amount is or they're worth less than the mortgage amount. And it's kind of a big wake-up call for people who thought they might have a paid-off asset worth a couple $100,000 and what they have is actually a big fat hole that paying off that mortgage could eat into other assets that there are in the estate.
Yeah, and they have to, realize, obviously, the mortgage comes with the house, and that's kind of, as you said, a wake-up call. People think they're getting this asset, but no, the mortgage comes with it. So you can, there's a lot of different things you could do. You can just let it go if you want. If you're not on that mortgage, you don't suffer the foreclosure and the credit score damage on your credit. But I think a lot of people are going to want to figure out some way to hang on to the family home or maybe, hope that equity turns around and they'll actually build up some equity over time and home prices will go up and it'll be a decent thing. But, if you've got a contentious family relationship where you guys don't get along anyway and you add in an underwater house to the deal, it can get pretty ugly pretty fast.
I think it can get pretty ugly. I think it is already getting ugly.
Yeah.
Out in the coast, where I know you live in the Los Angeles area, the coast of California seems to be recovering better than a lot of other markets in the country. Internally in California, sort of in the interior, it's dreadful, and you've got very high unemployment. Housing prices are really in the toilet. But you are seeing some places around the country where that's starting to improve. So maybe, to your point, some of those housing values will come back. It's just, I think, a little bit scary. What else do you have, are you seeing out there for maybe the younger baby boomers or the Gen X, Gen Ys who are sort of coming up now? They're too old to go live at home with mom and dad, but they are starting at the older end of that, starting to see them come back around. And they're supposed to live even longer than their parents. What's the outlook for them?
Well, this is why, and I'm sure you do this too, Elisa, we constantly talk about retirement savings because I think a lot of people are getting started too late with this. And Roger Ibbotson did some really interesting research on retirement savings and how much it really takes to retire and not have a huge drop in your lifestyle. And basically, if you haven't gotten started by the time you're 35, it's really, really tough to catch up. And that's going to be really depressing for some people to hear.
Well, we don't want them to not do anything. I mean, should they just throw up their hands and go,
I shouldn't even bother? Anything you save is going to help, obviously. But this is the message for the younger people, the people under 35, is don't put it off. Retirement is going to come. 80% of us make it to retirement age and beyond. So you're going to need to provide for yourself. Mom and dad probably aren't going to be able to help you. It's going to be up to you. Social Security is going to have to change somehow. It probably will be there, but maybe in an altered state. So you really can't mess around with this. You really got to make a focus of putting that money away from retirement. And unfortunately, it means making some tough decisions. Maybe you can't help your kids with college expenses as much as you wanted to or other education expenses. Maybe you can't help them with a down payment. A lot of families like to do that and they want to pass that money down. But if you're not saving enough for retirement, unfortunately you got to put yourself first. And just think about it this way, that they can always get loans for their education. You can't get loans for your retirement. And they don't particularly want to have you moving in with them because you're old and impoverished. So try to take care of yourself. Set a good example and do start saving. Even if, you got wiped out once, you can always start over. Anything you save is going to help.
Well, this week, the Census Bureau released its numbers showing a 35% drop in net worth for the median U.S. household between 2005 and 2010. I mean, it's really a rough decade, right? And financial assets minus debts, right? So net worth fell from about 103,000 in 2005 to 66,000 5 years later.
Oh, and if you look at the 35 to 44 year old group, it's even worse. They took a 50% hit. So it was, they really took it in the teeth. So that's, you know, obviously some of this has, they've recovered some of their equity in their home, or I'm sorry, they've recovered some of their investments. If they stayed invested in the market, you know, things have improved somewhat. And it, as I said, it does look like in some markets that the real estate prices are turning around. But yeah, that's a huge hit to take at a very difficult time for a lot of these families.
It is, and I wonder, you know, are people worried about recovering? I mean, are you concerned that they're not going to be able to recover? Because I, you know, I talk to some people, and everybody just feels so, you know, the folks I talk to, they're so despondent. They're, like, depressed about it. And it's very hard to gin it all up again and try and get back in the savings mode when you've watched, you know, $40,000 evaporate in thin air, nothing because of what you've done, but simply because of what's happened all over the place.
Yeah, and I think we need to remember that as human beings, we tend to think that whatever happened in the recent past is going to keep happening forever into the future ad infinitum, amen. And that is not reality. Things always change. I mean, when we have that attitude during booms, that's what fuels bubbles. Everybody thinks, oh, this is just going to keep going up and up and up. When we had, this is classic for a recession and post-recession, everybody thinks things are just going to keep getting worse. And the reality is, no, they're going to change. And the younger you are when this happens to you, the more time you have to recover. Where you start getting worried is if you're in your 50s and you've taken a big hit and you haven't, you know, started recovering, started amping up that savings rate to help replace some of that money that came back, you know, then it's not like you're looking at not retiring because you're going to have to quit work someday. You may be looking at a retirement that's very different than what you thought you'd have. And adjusting to that and adjusting your expectations is going to be tough. But, you know, you can't get there if you don't try at all. Well, if you just throw up your hands and say, whatever, you know, then you're going to have a retirement that consists of $1,000 a month from Social Security. If you can live on that, bless you. If you need a little bit more, it's going to have to come through your own efforts and your own savings.
I just wonder, you know, the stock market is nearing its highs again. It's back to where it was. It's nearly at 13,000. And yet, you know, we're all still down like 30-40% in our 401ks. And I don't know about you, but I haven't really changed my allocation. So I guess I'm not really sure why things are happening the way they happen. But you're right. You know, if we don't start rebuilding, it's, you know, time passes pretty darn quick. I know your daughter is just getting old before your eyes. My kids are like, you know, 6 feet plus tall, and I can't even see the top of their heads. So their time is passing, and it's, if you don't get started, it's just not going to happen. You are listening to Liz Weston, a great friend of the show. Her latest book, is called The 10 Commandments of Money, Survive and Thrive in the New Economy. You must get a look at this book. Go to Amazon. It is so incredibly helpful. You are going to want to own it, and you should just buy it and be done with it, because if you follow these 10 commandments, you are going to have a much happier financial life. Liz, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Elise.
All right. I'm going to send everybody to your website, lizweston.com.
AskLizWeston.com,
yes. Right. AskLizWeston.com. And then you can also find you at MSN Money, right?
Absolutely.
Sounds good. Thanks so much for joining us, Liz. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Liz Glenn Show. You know, when I talk to somebody like Liz Weston, it makes me really think about where I am in my own life. You know, with my two boys, I'm so fortunate that my mother has the financial wherewithal to be independent and will be able to continue to be independent. But there are so many people who aren't in that position. And if you are in financial difficulties, and you've got parents in financial difficulties and kids who have graduated from college or lost jobs, can't find the right thing to do, it's three generations of problems. Three generations that need an infusion of help in order to get their financial lives back on track. And it all starts with one step. One step that you take every single day to make your financial life better. Start with your own. Be selfish here. I want you to focus on what you're doing. So you start with your own, and then the next thing you do is move to your parents and help them, and then your children, because they can, of course, live with you once you get yourself straightened out. But everybody has to pitch in. It is so important. If not, the whole thing comes apart at the seams. And we are in such financial straits right now that everybody has to move in step together. I'm Elise Klink. Stay tuned. We're going to come back and have a whole nother hour of really amazing information. These are people you need to listen to. Stay tuned to News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Hey, we're live on Sundays, 11 to 1 on News Talk WSB, and we're talking about your money. Really, what could be more important to you on a Sunday morning? Not much. With me in the studio now is my good friend and editor at Money Watch. You hear me talk about Money Watch every week? Well, here's the guy who makes it happen, Jack Otter. He's the executive editor of Money Watch and the author of a brand new book that you must buy. It is the most beautifully designed book on personal finance I have ever seen, including my own, and it's called Worth It, Not Worth It, Simple and Profitable Answers to Life's Tough Financial Questions. Jack, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Well, that's a very welcoming introduction you've given me. Thank you, Elise.
You're welcome. This book is so gorgeous. I've been looking at it on Amazon, where you can buy it right now, and you should go there and do that. And it has, I have to say, I can honestly say, Jack, I have never seen a financial book that has a picture of a hot tub and girls in bikinis in it. Ever.
Well, radio is great. If this were TV, we could say it's not only pictures of hot tubs and girls. There must be some good-looking men in there, too, somewhere, I think.
I don't know. I think Getting Started, which is what is over that picture, you know, covers up the guys. But there is a really gorgeous picture of a lion. So, and I'm all about lions because I was...
And some cute puppies.
And some cute, right? There's some cute puppies. But really, the design is so engaging. And what I wanted to do is just talk to you a little bit about this book, because the whole concept behind personal finance is keeping people awake long enough to have the information imprinted in their brain, right? And this book does that.
Exactly. I mean, there is a lot of great financial information out there. You and I know many of the authors who've written these books. The problem is that most of them are in the format of a novel. And that's a great format for The Great Gatsby. And unfortunately, it doesn't really work for personal finance in a lot of cases because people don't want to spend that much time learning about this stuff. They probably should, but they're busy. You know, we've all got families and jobs and everything else. And so they end up buying those books and then just leaving it on the shelf and never opening them.
Well, this book really, I think, tells your magazine roots, because it looks, it does, it looks like a really slick magazine.
Well, I laugh because I think you're exactly right. Yeah. In many ways, this is about 100 short magazine articles in a book.
Right, which is actually very useful, and it's what people are used to reading these days, which is why, you know, the blogs on Money Watch work so well, right? You read one of my blogs, it's 500 words, you've learned something. If you really want to learn more, you can click to the other articles. You know, it's all
exactly
good, and it works beautifully. But what you bring to this project, and I don't think people really understand, is this tremendous history you've had editing and writing for financial magazines. So you were at Money Magazine for a long time, I think, weren't you?
It was actually Smart Money Magazine.
Smart Money.
Yes, very similar.
I get them both. I've been getting them both for years.
Exactly.
So you were at Smart Money for years. You've been at Money Watch for the last 3 years that I've been here.
Yep, exactly. And I was I handled personal finance at a rodeo publication called Best Life, a good magazine that was taken out of circulation and now is coming back.
Oh, well, it's always good to have a rerun, I suppose, especially if you're in the TV business. But let's talk a little bit about some of your favorite things with this, because in addition to the design, which is absolutely amazing, and the use of color and the humor, which I think is fantastic, and hopefully Jon Stewart will listen to my radio show this week. You know, sometimes he misses it, but hopefully he's listening this week and will invite you on, because I know you asked him to do that in your acknowledgments.
Yes, I did. I think that would be a good venue for the book. Also, he cracks me up, what can I say?
I know. He's a pretty funny guy. But you'd have to give him all of the money puns, which is, So some of the things that we talk about on the show every week are the finances surrounding sort of shelter, as you call it in your book, which is chapter two for you. And I think it's sort of interesting that you put shelter right at the top, because there has never been a better time to buy a house, and yet there are millions of Americans who are way underwater. We talk about it every week on our, you know, my Money Watch blog. But I think there's some real dichotomy going on here, where you've got people who should be out buying and people who should be paying down their loans and trying to rebuild that equity as quickly as possible. Where do you come down on it in the book?
In terms of whether to buy a house?
Yeah.
Well, I'm come down strongly in favor of it, but I'm going to start with the caveat that I give, and you and I have talked about this. While there are so many reasons to buy a house right now, which we can go into, I think there's still, believe it or not, after the crash, there is still a sense that everyone has to buy a house, that you're not really a grown-up until you've got your first mortgage. And I push back against that a little bit, and I urge people to think about their life circumstances before plunking down that down payment, and decide whether they might need the flexibility of being a renter. One of the problems with the employment situation right now is that people can't move for jobs because they can't sell their house because they're underwater. So rather than risk getting into that situation, be a renter, and then if a great job is offered to you and it's halfway across the country, that's no problem. You just break your lease, pay a small penalty, and you're off. Now, all of that said, the best argument, I think, for buying a house is what an economist's description of a house was, and that is a piggy bank that you live in. It's really a behavioral argument more than a financial argument, and the fact is that despite the problems many people have, most of us do scrape together that monthly mortgage payment, and we do it every month for 30 years, and sometimes even more, and after that period, we own an asset that's been going up, you know, forget the bubble and the post-bubble crash, roughly 1 point above inflation for a long time. And it's a very valuable asset. And if you don't have that discipline of paying that mortgage every month, the fact is that you'll probably spend a lot of that money on other stuff like dinners out and nicer cars and new sneakers. And at the end of 30 years, instead of having a very valuable asset, you have an asset you rent and you don't have any more savings than you would have the other way.
Well, let's talk about savings for a minute, because when I started the show, I talked about how I really believe there's a very good chance we could head back into recession. And I hope I'm wrong. I just feel like there's a lot of uncertainty with the election coming up. We've got the fiscal cliff that we just talked to Greg McBride of Bankrate about a little earlier. And the idea that we are so uncertain, businesses are uncertain, people are uncertain, people who've had jobs are worried about losing them, people who've been unemployed for 3-4 years are calling the show looking for guidance. There's just so much uncertainty, and yet, you know, if you aren't putting money away, if you aren't disciplined enough to be saving, whether it's in a 401k, a Roth IRA, just in a savings account, I'm not sure you're going to have any of those options. What do you talk about when you talk about savings for people and what to do and how much to put away? What's your advice?
Well, let's see, a couple of points. I mean, I think the very basic idea is the one that was in The Millionaire Next Door, another great finance
book.
I've been around a little longer than mine. And that is the idea that it doesn't make so much difference how much you earn, but it's that you spend less than you earn. And that the common thread among millionaires was not high incomes. It was that they all spent less than they earned. So whether that means setting a very strict budget for yourself and doing it that way, or just taking a hard look at every single purchase, and instead of thinking, why do I need this, think, how can I live without it? And if that's the bar that you have to clear before you buy something, there's a good chance you'll be living below your means. So for college students, when they graduate, what that means is continue to live like a college student when you get out of college. You know, don't jump and think that your new rental home has to be furnished perfectly. Instead, maybe stay with your parents for a while and put away those first few paychecks. If you're a little bit older, buy a used car instead of a new one. Maybe it's a gently used car. But instead of always getting the the shiniest thing. And, you know, this is from a guy who still watches a tube TV when he has time to watch TV. So I do practice what I preach to a certain extent. So that's number one, is keep the spending down. In terms of rules of thumb for saving, it does depend a lot on the individual circumstance, but certainly maxing out your 401k is kind of the first step, not the ultimate goal, but that'll be where you start, frankly. And then if you can put away more in either a Roth or a traditional IRA, that's great. And of course, these days, with all of our jobs so tenuous, the emergency fund is even more important than ever, so that if you do lose that job due to layoffs or your company goes bankrupt or whatever, you don't have to dip into the retirement savings, but you've got a little bit of a cushion while you look for a job.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had a caller last week. He's been unemployed for 3 years, went back into the healthcare industry, got retrained, can't find a job in the healthcare industry of all things, which is really, really terrible. But yet he asked me how he has a couple of little freelance jobs. Should he start an IRA? He's worried about retirement. I said, look, you got bigger issues than your retirement. Retirement's 30 years down the line for you. You really need to think about having an emergency fund, having that rainy day fund, because it's pouring on you.
Sure.
And so this idea that you can, I love that he's thinking about the future, but I'm really worried about him with the present. And so I think people kind of underestimate how important it is to have that cash on hand. I mean, if your car breaks down and you need to replace the radiator, you don't really want to be dipping into that 401k for that, or an IRA, or even a Roth.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact is that especially if you... you know, if you're a homeowner and you have a car and therefore a washing machine and a refrigerator and a stove and a roof, one of those things is going to break in the next 6 months.
It all broke for me at year 10. We did our house, and like year 10, every single appliance in the kitchen died except the stove, and that needed some fixing.
So people should not be surprised. You know, these things do not come out of the blue. You don't know when it's going to happen, but you can be guaranteed it's going to happen. So, in effect, start paying for it now. Putting that money into a savings account means that instead of borrowing or raiding a retirement account, the money's there.
So the worst part for so many people, young people particularly, is the dreaded student loans. You've got $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $80,000 of student loans, and you get out of school, and then you have to start paying them back. Really scary for a lot of people. You know, what do you advise? I have one of my web producers, Jen, and I've talked about her on the show before. She came to me right out of grad school, $80-something thousand dollars in debt, and 4 years later, she's paid off all but $25,000 of it.
Wow, that's impressive. That's great.
It's impressive, but she's practicing exactly what you're preaching, which is, man, if I don't absolutely need to do that, I'm not doing it. And she, in addition to that, she's managed to buy her first condo. So it is possible to do this. What are some tips that you have for folks?
Well, I actually, in the book, I start off with the question of, do you even need to go to college? And the answer is yes.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I thought we were going to have a mitt moment for a moment.
No. And the simple reason is this: as expensive as it is and as painful as it's going to be to pay off those loans, the one statistic that I think just to win the argument hands down is the unemployment rate for college graduates right now is 4.1%. Compare that to the national rate of a little bit over 8%, and of course in some states it's much higher than that. So clearly in this economy, and it's going to be even more important in the future, you're going to need that college degree. So how do you get it without going into debt for the rest of your life? You know, one neat trick, and this really only works frankly for disciplined students, but if you can go to a community college for 2 years and really put your nose to the grindstone, get good grades, you can transfer to a four-year college. You'll have that four-year degree, but you will have essentially gotten it for 2 years and change.
And it only matters. It only matters where the degree is from. Great
exactly.
Point.
Yeah. And also, you know, as hard as it is to think about this when you're a college, when you're a high school student, you do have to think realistically about what your job opportunities are going to be when you get out from your chosen career and what kind of a debt load you can handle. So if your finance is your thing and you are able to get into a great school and have a decent chance of getting one of those Wall Street jobs, you're in a very different position from somebody who plans to become an elementary school teacher.
Right. And so maybe then the debt that you take on is worth it,
yeah,
rather than not being worth it. Jack Otter is the author of Worth It, Not Worth It, A Simple and Profitable Answers to Life's Tough Financial Questions. It's an amazing book. It is the most beautifully designed financial book I've ever seen, and you should buy it right now on Amazon.com. Jack, thanks so much.
It's been great to be with you, Lisa.
I will chat with you on Money Watch on Monday. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be back in a moment with more on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show on News Talk WSB. I just want to give you, for all of those who just tweeted me wondering what the name of the book was, we had Jack Otter, as in the animal, on with us in his new book, which is fabulous. Worth It, Not Worth It, Simple and Profitable Answers to Life's Tough Financial Questions. The book is in color, and as Jack said, it is seriously like having a whole bunch of magazine articles strung together that gives it to you in just a really fun and entertaining way. So if you normally get put to sleep and by every financial book you read, my financial books are not as beautiful as this, but the next ones will be. You are going to want to click on Amazon.com right now. Look up Jack Otter. The book is called Worth It, Not Worth It, Simple and Profitable Answers to Life's Tough Financial Questions. I will also link to it from the ThinkLink blog so that you can find it there as well. And you don't want to miss it. Jack is super smart. He's been doing this for a really long time. And I work with him every day at Money Watch, where you can read my home equity blog. All right, when we come back, we're going to have a conversation about the mortgage market, what's going on with it, and property values across the country, and of course here in Atlanta. My next guest, Fred Glick, I've known him for ages. I guess it'll be the Glick and Glink half hour, but you'll want to stay with me as we go through your best bet for refinancing the rest of this year. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. We're live on Sundays, every Sunday, 11 to 1 on News Talk WSB, talking about real estate and your money and helping you make sense of your single biggest investment. Whether you're buying or selling or investing, there is so much you need to know in order to make the smartest move possible. And that's what we want you to do here at the Elise Glink Show. You can join us online, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Don't forget, while you're there, to sign up for the free weekly newsletter. We have something cool going on every single day, and we want you to be a part of that. You can also join me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Fred Glick joins us now. He is the president and CEO of U.S. Loans Mortgage and U.S. Spaces. He is a mortgage lender and a real estate broker. He has been watching the mortgage and real estate markets for a very long time, and he's been, I think, a guest on the show at least once or twice, but I'm happy to have him back. Fred, welcome back.
Thanks, Elise. Thanks for having me here.
Sure. So one of the things that we talk about every week is that we are at virtually the lowest mortgage rates in history, and yet every week I look at the number of originations and it seems to also be at an extraordinarily low level. People aren't able to really take advantage of these rates. Do you have any idea why that is?
Well, yeah, first of all, we are at the lowest rates since, I believe, the Andrew Jackson administration, and it's a sign that the rates are down because there is a lack of demand. It's the simple economic theories of supply and demand. The problem is, during the mid-decade of the last decade, whatever the aughts, whatever we ended up calling it, we had this phenomenon that was caused by one word, and that was fraud. So all this fraud happened, increased everybody's values, all the excitement went up, we had all these insane loans. And now we've gone from being all the way to the far left-hand corner of the underwriting scale to now all the way to the right-hand corner of the underwriting scale. So the lenders are scared to make loans because they think that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and FHA and VA won't buy the loan or make them buy it back because of one thing that is ridiculous. So because of that, that's the major problem, that they're just scared to lend unless you're ridiculously perfect.
In other words, if you don't need the money, that's when they want you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So it's kind of interesting because there's so much talk about what is actually going to happen to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And, you know, there's quite a strong movement, I'm surprised by this, of people who just would like to get rid of them altogether and let the big banks start forming their own mortgage secondary markets, which I think is probably a recipe for disaster all over again in a different way.
God. And you have no idea.
Well, tell us, why is that as bad an idea as I actually think it is?
Here is, first of all, I'll kind of give you what my idea is to do with the market, and then I'll work backwards to it. What Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, and USDA are basically are places where you go to either have a loan insured or a loan guaranteed or a loan passed through to what's called the secondary market. So my idea is let's form one agency of the federal government that says here's a set of good quality guidelines, and if you follow these good quality guidelines, we'll put a rubber stamp on the loan to say, God forbid something happens and the loan goes into default, we as the United States government will back that loan up. And my idea is to also have some type of insurance with each and every loan to come up with an insurance pool like you have the MIP idea on FHA. This way, no matter who makes the loan, it can get the stamp of approval going through the computer system, eliminate all the massive amounts of people in these agencies, and then the mortgage-backed security market will be happy to sell the paper to people, to organizations like the pension funds of Norway or the Chinese banks. These are the people who actually control the mortgage market. So to go to Chase, Citi, Bank of America, or any of these big banks who will just lend money, it's never going to happen, because where do they get the money to lend? They get it from you having your savings account. So if your savings account pays 1% and they're able to lend it out at 3%, they make 2%. It's called a spread. But the problem is, just like what happened in 1979, 1980, rates went up to 18%. So if they're sitting on the books with 3% mortgages and they have to pay you 18% for a CD, well, they're negative 15% and they go out of business. So that's why this whole thing of selling the loans off came into fruition. Now, the banks do get a fee every month for what's called servicing a loan, taking the mortgage payment. So really, Bank America is not really your lender. All they are is a place to send your mortgage to, and then they send the money to Fannie Mae, who then sends it to the mortgage-backed security number 1074739.
Yeah.
That's owned in part by the pension fund in Norway.
Right, but the real issue, though, Fred, is this idea that somebody's got, some company, some entity has to securitize these mortgages. Somebody has to stand behind them. The talk of, you know, getting rid of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which have worked okay, except that by being quasi-private, you know, I don't know where everybody was asleep at the switch when they were starting, the CEOs were starting to collect like $18 million a year for doing essentially nothing. You know, managing this has got to be some sort of a government-backed entity, or, you know, I can't even imagine what you would put into place that would work just as well.
It's really just we have to look at the computers. And the computers, you know, the big black box that says, okay, let's do this loan or not do this loan. Let's guarantee this loan through these guidelines or not. And it's got to be common sense. You can't do away with FHA mortgages. That would absolutely just destroy the housing market. They're a big part of the first-time buyers. Same with VA. As a matter of fact, a lot of people don't know, VA has the lowest amount of foreclosures and delinquents of any source, and they were 100% financing. So, you know, if you underwrite a loan properly and you give it to the right people, it's not going to be an issue except if they start massively losing jobs. Well, you're always going to have divorces. You're always going to have just situations where people can't pay. But over the long run, you have to have this federal stopgap, but now it's in five agencies, and I'm talking about putting it into one much smaller agency that's concentrated on an underwriting guideline and a computer system, and letting the free markets go out and make the loans, knowing that it's going to be okay if something goes wrong. And then
right, but you're what you're talking about is having government underwriting all mortgages, not having a free market system.
Well, all you're saying is we'll insure it.
No, you're saying the government's the stopgap.
If you underwrite to these guidelines.
No, you're saying the government's the stopgap. Which was always the implication, which was always the implication for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Correct, but they just made it a little big.
I see. So you're so you want it to be a smaller amount that the government is actually backing. It's interesting.
Yeah,
I just don't know how it's
a mini me version of Fannie, let's call it.
Okay. Well, let's talk about people who are sort of in the free market side, who are out, you know, shopping around for a mortgage, and it is so very tough for them to actually get something. I mean, I've had people call the show and they've been rejected for a loan because they had a $1,500 loss on a $500,000 income. Everything looks perfect, but this $1,500 loss was as a passive investor in, like, a nephew's business. And they got rejected because they said, well, we don't know. Next year it might be a $150,000 loss.
Yeah.
And, like, the business is $20,000. It's not going to ever be a $150,000 loss. But in a bank's mind, this is just it becomes such a paranoid question mark. So what
paranoid is a great word.
Pete, what is the right way for people to go about looking for a loan?
Well, there's a lot of components. One is the appraisal. That's a nightmare, especially if you have an appreciating market. The comps don't catch up to the values. And there's the HBCC nightmares that we're still continuing to have of very unqualified, underpaid appraisers coming up with values that are just insane. Income is the second hardest thing, especially for self-employed people. I had one situation where someone made, I'm making the numbers up, like $50,000 net income in 2010, but they made $49,000 the next year, and the loan was rejected for declining income, even though with the $49,000 they qualified with no problem. You know, somebody needs to, I don't know, smack these underwriters in the head and deal in reality, instead of dealing just looking at the guideline. The other thing that happened, a lot of people don't realize, when the crash happened and the mortgage companies literally stopped lending, they were able then to fire the really experienced underwriters, and they disappeared most of them out of the business. So the new underwriters that they've hired in the last couple of years have learned exactly what the guidelines say and have no ability to interpret reality. They're just going by the guidelines, and they also, the banks have scared them into underwriting conservatively.
That makes me so mad.
I know.
It makes me really mad, because what we're doing is setting ourselves up for failure. Unless banks are willing to actually take a risk and lend to somebody who needs the loan as opposed to somebody who just doesn't need the loan, we're not going to ever get anywhere in this country. We're not going to come back. We're not going to build a strong rebuild our strong financial system, and we're not going to rebuild trust from
right.
people in the financial system. It has to be both things to work. You need a strong financial system, and you need trust in the financial system. And if you don't have both, we're not going to build, you know, America great again. It's just not
sure.
going to happen.
And you have the CFPB and the Dodd-Frank rules, and everybody's interpreting them differently. And they're making it more difficult for people to, here's another part of this, they're making it more difficult for people to actually get loans that are at a good price. And this jumps into an article I read in the Wall Street Journal by Alan Zibel the other day, where the banks have even admitted on the HARP loans that they're charging big fees to do it, because most people think you have to go back to your lender, like Bank America to Bank America or Chase to Chase, when in fact you don't normally under the program. But the other problem is the wholesale lenders that I deal with have been cutting back from unlimited loan to value to 105% loan to value, so that if you have an over 105%, you've got to go back to your lender because they're the only one that's going to do it. And they're going to charge you whatever you feel they feel like.
And that
charging
was
you.
So against the whole point of HARP. It was supposed to not be ripping
totally.
Off the consumer. It was supposed to be helping. But what they're doing is they're adding $8,000-$10,000 in fees onto the back end of the loan. So it's even worse than that. You're just paying fees on top of interest on top of fees, and it makes me
right.
sick.
And they're usually financing them into the loan, so it's now at a higher loan to value. It's just, hello. I had meetings with people at the White House about HARP before HARP 2 before it came out, and they were in total agreement with me of how to do it and what to do, and they really wanted to help. But the banks have just been putting the brakes on purpose. The FHFA hasn't really helped. They won't tell the banks to do anything. The interim director won't listen to anything. Even FHA at this point, they just started a refi program where it can be really cheap on the upfront and the monthly mortgage insurance, but then the lenders started throwing their little layers into it to make it even tougher.
That's crazy.
So it's just, you got to drudge through it and put pressure on your congresspeople. They're all running for re-election this year. If you have any kind of mortgage problem, because they have people on staff who do real estate and mortgages, and you find that person in their congressional office or...
And then you keep calling them nonstop until
exactly.
they actually help you. We're
exactly.
We've got Fred Glick with us today, fredglick.com. It's almost like my name, but it's glick.com. We're going to confuse everybody, but I'm going to put it up at the ThinkLink blog so that you can see it, and we will tweet about it. Fred Glick, glick.com. Mortgage lender and real estate broker and all-around smart guy. Fred, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Working me up there, at least.
Well, you better answer all the emails, right?
Not a problem.
All right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I will be back next week for another adventure with you in real estate. Glad you could join us today. If you've got information that you think I need to know or you want to ask me a question, go to my website, thinklink.com, thinklink.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay tuned to News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
That time again, the music's playing, and that means that our time is up. But it has been a great show. I hope you've learned as much as I have. It is just always good to have really smart people around to tell you and reconfirm what you already know inside that you're supposed to be doing, which is being smart with your money and your home and all of the things that go with it. I'll be back next week. In the meantime, don't forget to check out my Twitter feed. Go to moneywatch.com. And don't forget to check out the Equifax Finance blog. There is so much going on there. We want you to share in it. Have a great week, everybody. See you soon.